You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Okay, so let's start with our motivation. Okay, so think of a year ago. Okay, August 20th, 2014. And we have problems every day, don't we? So, what was your problem 1 year ago? So every day we have a problem. Every day our problem seems so completely important, so overwhelming, overriding. So what was your problem a year ago? Can you remember it? What was your mind spinning about 1 year ago? Or maybe try 2 years ago, August 20th, 2013. What was your mind worried, aggravated, upset, paranoid, whatever it was? What was the issue 2 years ago? How about August 20th, when you were 7 years old? What was overwhelming your mind that seemed so real and so difficult when you were 7 years old, August 20th? So, I think by now we've probably realized that whatever seems of crucial importance, that feels so objectively real to us, on one day, we can't remember even a year later. That makes us wonder, why were we so upset about it on that one day? And it was such a big thing, why can't we even remember it? So when we observe how this happens in our mind, it helps us to understand how the afflictions operate. Because we can see that, you know, whatever the problem was a year ago, we were grasping at a truly existent me. There was inappropriate attention, exaggerating the good or bad qualities of the object. We responded and reacted with some strong emotion, and the whole situation seems so solid, so real, so objective, out there, cast in concrete. And if that were really so, how come we can't remember it now? If that problem we had was really so overwhelming, so serious, why can't we remember it now? So we see how the mind, the afflicted mind, ignorance, inappropriate attention, the various disturbing emotions, we see how they deceive us. We see how they trap us and bind us in a way that's completely unnecessary. So seeing that all of that is unnecessary gives us a little glimmer that, oh, it's possible to eliminate these things. They're deceptive. The picture they paint isn't true. My wisdom sees that now. What would it be like to have really profound wisdom that just could clear away all that garbage from my mind? And stop fabricating self-centered problems that, you know, whose existence are dubious. And then we see that every single sentient being suffers from the same deceptive afflictions as we do. We see how they're all tricked by thinking that whatever they perceive is objectively real. And we see how all of us together create so much karma that not only causes our rebirth, but causes us tremendous suffering now, as well as in the future lives. Now we develop some compassion for ourselves and for others, wishing all of us to be free from this culprit of ignorance. And knowing that it's possible to be free from the ignorance. And so with compassion for ourselves and others, let's listen to the Dharma teachings so that we will know the method to practice to free our own mind and to help other living beings free theirs. Is that little exercise useful? Does it make today's overwhelming difficulty seem a little bit less important, a little bit less solid, a little bit more hilarious? And does it make it seem that what sentient beings suffer to be really sad and unnecessary? Yeah. How sentient beings fabricate so many things due to ignorance and then suffer so much unnecessarily. And can you imagine what it's like for the bodhisattvas who have this overwhelming compassion for us, to see us in this confused state, knowing that it doesn't have to be like this? Now we maybe understand why Chenrezig's head cracked into 11 pieces, you know? Because you see, it's like all this suffering is so unnecessary. and yet beings suffer so much. But the mind just fabricates. And we begin to understand how the different realms exist because the mind fabricates them. So this is helpful to bear in mind on a daily basis, so we put things into perspective. And it's, you know, it also helps us to not get angry at other living beings when their minds are overwhelmed by garbage. Yeah, because we see it's not that living beings are wrong or bad or this or that. It's just that ignorance and afflictions are running the show. That's why Shantideva says if you're going to be angry, you have to be angry at the afflictions, not at the person. Okay, so we were on verse 45, right? So actually verse 43 and 44, just to review, Nagarjuna was saying that a nihilistic view is seeing that karma has no effects, that cause and effect doesn't work, doesn't function. And that's a nihilistic view, and that leads you to a lower rebirth. Okay, because when we think there's no such thing as karma and its effects, then we do who knows what kind of actions, negative actions, and that leads us to a lower rebirth. Then a realistic view is the belief that karma has an effect, that our actions do have effects. And that view leads us to a higher rebirth. Yeah. Because even though our mind still has ignorance in it, the view is correct and the karma we create is still virtuous. Okay, so that's a right view regarding the world. That isn't a right view regarding the ultimate nature of things. Okay, it's the right view regarding karma and its effects. Then verse 45 says, through knowledge one subdues the notions of existence and non-existence, and one thus transcends negativity and merit. So in the previous verse, it was saying what was meritorious and what was non-meritorious. Here he's saying, let's transcend meritorious and non-meritorious altogether. Hence, one is liberated from high and low rebirth. This is what the Holy One says. Okay, so the previous verse, two verses we're talking about, how to create the causes for a good rebirth in samsara by having the correct worldly view. And this one is saying, let's transcend that notion of negativity and merit. In other words, let's transcend the mind that is preoccupied with a higher rebirth and a lower rebirth and then thus wants to create merit and avoid non-virtue. And instead, let's focus on transcending that whole samsaric system and attaining liberation. Okay? And how do we do that? Through knowledge that subdues the notions of existence and non-existence. Now here, you go transcend notions of existence and non-existence. What else is there if we don't have existence or non-existence? So we have to add some qualifying words in here. Okay? So that subdues the notions of inherent existence and total non-existence. Okay? So, this verse is talking about how liberation is the extinction of true grasping. True grasping here means grasping true existence. Okay? So true grasping has been extinguished at both nirvana with remainder and without remainder. Okay, remember we said the common, these two types of nirvana can be posited in different ways, okay? So the way acceptable to all of the Buddhist tenet systems was the one explained before, where nirvana with remainder was the arhat had eliminated all the afflictive obscurations, but still had the remainder of this body, which was taken, which is a polluted body, because when the arhat was born, they were still born under the influence of afflictions and polluted karma. And then nirvana without remainder is when the arhat dies and separates from this body. Okay? Some of the lower schools say when that happens, that then the continuity of consciousness of the arhat stops. Okay? The Majjhimaka school says, no, there's nothing that can stop the continuity of consciousness. But so the consciousness continues, but it is in a purified form. Okay? So that's the general way acceptable to all the Buddhist tenet systems. But the Prasangika also have their own unique way of positing or explaining nirvana with and without remainder. Okay? So when arhats are in non-conceptual meditative equipoise on emptiness, only emptiness appears to that mind. There's no appearance of any conventional object whatsoever. Yeah? It's like Jeffrey was talking, you have, it's like the consciousness and the mind, you know, like water and water put together in the same thing, undifferentiable. Okay? So that, from the Prasangika view, is called nirvana without remainder, because there's no remainder of the appearance of true existence at all. Okay? When the arhat arises from their meditation and they're, you know, going around washing dishes and brushing their teeth and, you know, working in the forest and doing things like that, then the arhat has the appearance of true existence to their minds, but they don't grasp at true existence, because they realize that that appearance is false. Okay, but still the true existence appears to them, so that's called nirvana with remainder, the remainder again being the appearance of true existence. Okay, so in the view common to all the schools, first you have nirvana with remainder of the polluted body. Second, nirvana without remainder of the polluted body. According to the Prasangikas, first you have nirvana without remainder of the appearance of true existence. And when you emerge from that, then you have nirvana with remainder, because true existence, you know, although it doesn't exist, still falsely appears to that mind. Okay? So one is called meditative equipoise, the other is called subsequent attainment. These terms came up when we studied paths and grounds too, you may remember. Okay? So this particular verse here explains that liberation in the continuum or continua of hearer and solitary realizer arhats at the time of nirvana without remainder, when they're meditating single-pointedly on emptiness, is the extinction of true grasping. So what is nirvana without remainder? The extinction of true grasping. Okay, the true cessation of grasping true existence. In addition, at the time of the nirvana with remainder, when they're not in equipoise. Okay. The liberation in their continuum is also the extinction of true grasping. So when they get up, the arhats, they've eliminated all the afflictive obscurations. So they still have that extinction or elimination of grasping true existence, even though true existence is appearing to their mind. Okay? Because the appearance of true existence is a cognitive obscuration. And arhats have eliminated only the afflictive obscurations. Okay? So in the verse, when it says, through knowledge one subdues the notions of existence and non-existence, okay? Through knowledge means that through realizing and meditating with the wisdom that non-conceptually realizes the ultimate mode of existence, emptiness, that through that mind, through that meditation, that pacifies all the views of true existence and non-existence. In other words, or it says just literally the views of existence and non-existence. In other words, it pacifies the grasping phenomena to be truly existent or grasping them to be totally non-existent. Okay? And there, it means non-existent even conventionally. Okay, so so even at the time of nirvana with remainder, when arhats are not meditating on emptiness and have the appearance of true existence, true grasping is no longer present in their continua, so they no longer have afflictions, they no longer create the karma to be born in samsara. Okay. So they no longer create this polluted karma created under the influence of ignorance that is meritorious or not meritorious. So they no longer are born in higher or lower realms by virtue of that polluted karma. Okay, so that's what it means that they attain liberation. And when Nagarjuna says, this is what the Holy One says, that indicates that he's, paraphrasing or quoting something that the Buddha said in a sutra. Okay? So, to encapsulate it, through directly realizing and continually meditating on emptiness, the true grasping is gradually eliminated. And when that's eliminated, the virtuous and non-virtuous polluted karma that causes rebirth is eliminated. And when those karmas are eliminated, then rebirth in cyclic existence stops. Okay? No new karmas for rebirth are created, and whatever ones that could cause rebirth that are still in the arhat's mind can no longer ripen because they no longer have the links of craving and clinging that make karma ripen, because craving and clinging operate due to ignorance. And the ignorance is gone. Okay? So that's how, the afflictions and the karma is extinguished and how rebirth in samsara stops. Okay? So verse 46, seeing that production has a cause, one transcends the notion of non-existence. Seeing that cessation has a cause, one does not accept the notion of existence. This is an interesting verse. Okay? So it deals with freedom from the extremes of existence and non-existence regarding cause and effect. Okay? So we always say the prasangikas are free of the two extremes, of non-existence and existence. Here, non-existence means total non-existence. It's the extreme of nihilism. And the extreme of existence means inherent existence, which is sometimes called the extreme of permanence, of eternalism, and that's the absolutist extreme. Okay. So saying production has a cause means that cyclic existence has a cause. Okay. And those with the correct view know with their reliable cognizers that the arising of dukkha in cyclic existence has a cause. What's that cause? Self-grasping, or true grasping, or grasping inherent existence, however you want to say it. So in this way, knowing that samsara has that cause, they transcend the wrong view that there are no causes for wandering in cyclic existence. And in that way, they're free from the view of non-existence. Okay. Now imagine what it would be like if you had that view that there are no causes to cyclic existence. Okay? Let's say you had that view. You're stuck in samsara, and there are no causes to it. Then what?
Take drugs.
Yeah. You take drugs and you get drunk. Yeah? You do what you want, you numb your pain. And that's all you can do, because that wrong view doesn't give you any alternative. Because if the suffering has no cause, then there's no way to eliminate it. And then you're stuck in samsara for eternity. Ugh. How awful. Yeah? And there's no way out. And suicide doesn't even work because you just get reborn. Yeah? So that extreme view of non-existence leads somebody to, I think, really severe depression and confusion in their lives. And then you just self-medicate any way you possibly can, because it doesn't seem like there's any alternative to what you're experiencing, because you don't believe what you're experiencing has any causes, so there's no causes to eliminate so that you can't change anything. Then you're really stuck. Yeah, really stuck. Okay? So prasangikas have eliminated that kind of nihilistic view. They've also eliminated the view of existence, because they see with reliable cognizers that the cessation of dukkha has a cause, the true path. Okay, so true cessation comes into being due to the power of meditating on the true path, the direct realization of emptiness. And in this way, the prasangikas avoid the extreme of absolutism. Yeah, because if you said that the causes of samsara were inherently existent, then they could never be eliminated, because inherently existent things don't depend on causes and conditions, so you could never cease them, and then again you're stuck getting born again and again and again. So by seeing that true cessation has a cause, you know, the true paths, then, you know, we leave aside the wrong view of inherent existence or the absolutist extreme. So, now I have a question here. Yeah? This verse says that true cessation, nirvana, has a cause, meditating on true path. But isn't true cessation, isn't nirvana permanent? Hazel, what do you say?
Exactly, I have the question marks right here in my book.
Yeah.
What?
Okay, Salami, what do you think?
Just problem with language.
Problem with language? What do you think it means? What's the solution?
Well, you have to generate wisdom So we have to do something. Mm-hmm. But eliminating something is different from creating something, I guess. That's not right.
I haven't thought. No.
Yeah.
The true cessations are actually a conventional phenomena. The cessation itself is empty, but when we say true cessations, we're talking about
true cessations are conventional truths.
The
They're truths for an obscured mind.
No, the actual cessation is not, but when we talk about it, we have to talk about it in conventional terms.
Right? Yeah. But conventional terms still doesn't have a cause. It's permanent.
The cessations are then a negation of something, and a negation can be permanent.
Yeah, that's the point. They're permanent. The permanent things don't have a cause. And here it's saying that true cessation has a cause.
Why can't a negation have a cause?
If it's permanent, things don't have causes.
But they are dependent arisings.
They're considered dependent arisings.
Not causal, but they're not.
But they are not caused. Okay. You know, in Three Principal Aspects of the Path, when it, what's the verse? When it talks about the cause and effect of samsara and nirvana? Yeah? Oh, cause and effect, okay, of samsara. A cause and effect of nirvana? Nirvana's permanent. So you want to know the secret?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
you're partially right in terms of when you said it's language. What it means is, yeah, nirvana, true cessations, emptiness, they're permanent, they do not have causes. However, since meditating on the true path, the realization of emptiness, yeah, brings about nirvana, brings about true cessation, we say that that is the cause of true cessation, but it's not actually the cause of true cessation, because we don't say the true path causes, well, we don't say that true cessation arises due to the true path. We say true cessation comes about due to the true path. So there's a difference between arising and comes about. Arising means it's produced by. Yeah, it comes about, well, meditating on the path. Yeah, true cessations come about, don't they? Yeah. So we say that the true path is the cause of nirvana, but it's not really the cause. But nirvana comes about due to meditating on the true path.
Does this sound like fudgy?
Yeah.
Well, maybe. But we're used to fudgy right now, aren't we?
Could you use the example of the absence of an elephant in this room?
Yeah.
Same.
Yeah, did anything, the absence?
We haven't created anything by knowing that, in a sense.
Yeah.
We haven't created the absence of the elephant.
Yeah, because the absence of the elephant is permanent. But for you want to be able to show that there's some relationship between meditating on you know, with wisdom on emptiness and gaining nirvana. You need to show there's some relationship. It's not a causal relationship because the result is permanent. But we say that the true path is a cause of nirvana, meaning that the meditating on the true path, or meditating with the true path, brings about nirvana. It doesn't cause it, it brings it about.
Could you translate it using depends on?
It's
rather than cause?
Yeah, nirvana, attaining nirvana, depends on meditating.
Yeah.
Yeah, saying depends on doesn't necessarily mean cause.
Right, that's what I'm saying. If we replace cause with depends on.
Yeah, we replace cause with depends on and cause with, or, you know, bring, or produce with bring about. Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah. Okay. Still, how does seeing that cessation has a cause eliminate the extreme of absolutism or inherent existence? How does seeing that eliminate the extreme of absolutism or the extreme of inherent existence? This part's very interesting. So emptiness exists because it can be realized by a reliable cognizer. Okay? And through directly realizing emptiness with a reliable cognizer and continuing to meditate on it, we attain true cessation or nirvana. So this dependent sequence refutes anything being independent. It refutes independent existence. And remember, independent existence is the same as inherent existence. And inherent existence is the extreme of existence. So by understanding that dependence, you refute the extreme of existence. That's interesting, isn't it? I wouldn't have thought of that on my own, probably. Probably because I wouldn't have even thought and had the question come into my mind. But, you know, if you really think deeply, then that question comes. How would this prove that? Okay. Then verse 47, this is also interesting. You'll have flashbacks of Aryadeva. A cause that occurs before its effect or simultaneous with it is not really a cause at all, because such causes are not accepted nominally, and arising is not accepted ultimately. Okay? So this view, this verse is also presenting another reasoning refuting inherent existence that is also brought up in Nagarjuna's Karikas. Okay? So, an imputedly existent cause, okay, an iris bulb, okay, producing an inherently existent effect, an inherently existent iris, is impossible, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Actually, it says an imputedly existent. It should say an inherently existent. Cause, yes, not me.
Either way.
Yeah, either way it doesn't work, but it's better because the next sentence says if a cause existed inherently, this one should say inherently. Because nobody would ever say the cause exists imputedly, but the effect exists inherently. Okay, so if an inherently existent cause producing an inherently existent an inherently existent cause producing an inherently existent effect is impossible, okay? Because if a cause existed inherently, it would have to exist either before its effect, simultaneous with effect, or after its effect, okay? So there's no other possibility. So let's see if any of these work. Yeah. So a cause, it's easy to eliminate, a cause cannot exist simultaneous with the effect because the cause has to cease for the effect to arise. So throw out that option. The cause existing after the effect is ridiculous, so throw out that option. Mm-hmm. So then we're left with the cause existing before the effect, which seems quite reasonable. But does an inherently existent cause exist before an inherently existent effect? That is the question. Okay? So that can't be, because an inherently existent cause is independent, unrelated to anything else. It's a self-enclosed entity. And a self-enclosed entity can't produce anything. It can't change, so it couldn't cease before producing an effect. It just has to be permanent and there all the time. Okay? So that option doesn't work either. So then any kind of inherently existent arising can't work. Okay? So if an inherently existent cause could produce an inherently existent effect, there should be a valid reason that proves it, and there should be a valid cognizer that shows it, but there's neither of those. Okay. So in the context of effects conventionally arising from causes, that works. Okay. A cause has to exist before its effect. However, inherently existent causes and effects do not exist either nominally, conventionally, or ultimately. Okay. Now, does it sound different to you to say that a conventionally existent cause produces a conventionally existent effect? How does that sound versus a nominally existent cause produces a nominally existent effect? Is there a difference in feeling for you? What's the difference?
Conventional existence is real. Nominally is not.
Yeah. Nominally gives us much more the feeling that is created by conception, that is fabricated. When we say conventionally, we're so used to, well, conventionally just means what I see, so we automatically go to, well, it's really there, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. So it might be better to always say nominally. But then we go, but wait a minute, how is this cause only nominally existent? It looks so real. That iris bulb is real. It's not just a nominally existent iris bulb. I can see it. I can touch it. I plant it in the ground, and next spring we're going to get irises. Real irises. Yeah. Nominally existent irises are just made up things in a comic book. That's what we think, isn't it? As soon as we hear nominally existent, made up in a comic book, that's stupid, that's non-existent. Conventionally existent ones, and then we think conventionally means truly, those are real. Yeah?
What is the difference? It's how it sounds
in English. Mm-hmm. Actually, conventionally and nominally pretty much mean the same thing. But in English, when you say something exists conventionally, to our ears it sounds much more real than saying it exists nominally. Nominally means due to names. Yeah, due to names and conception, which gives us the feeling that things are made up. But conventionally, we just feel like, well, yeah, that's what I see with my eyes.
It's established.
And that's real.
It feels established.
Yeah. It's established as real. Okay? So we have to be careful when we use the word conventional, because it doesn't always bring the same impact to us. Yeah? As saying, like, fabricated or nominally existent, which our mind really rebels against, doesn't it? Yeah. What do you mean this bell is fabricated by my mind? It's not fabricated by my mind. I don't have any psychic powers to go boom and make a bell appear. What are you saying is fabricated by mind? This is real. I can touch it. Yeah? And it hurts my head when I hit my head. This thing is real, isn't it? What's this baloney about it being fabricated?
It's not, it's conventional.
Okay. So then we're really seeing this is how things appear to us. Now how are we gonna refute that? Yeah? Our experience is so real, doesn't it? So how are we going to refute our experience of this as a real bell?
Ask a stink bug.
Huh?
Ask a stink bug.
Ask a stink bug. Yeah. Or you could say, is this a bell or is it a gong? Or a cup, or a bowl,
or a hat, or a small scroll.
Jackie Kennedy style.
A shrunk bowl.
Yeah. Yeah, or maybe it's an Anisha. It's Anisha. Oh. Yeah. Okay. So if this existed truly as the referent of a name, how could we call it by different names that make it become different things? How, if this were truly a bell, how could it also be a bowl? Yeah? If it had the essence of bellness in it, then what happened to the essence of bowlness? Yeah. If this thing were inherently a bowl, then if you back it up in time, and you have the metal just as a blob there, the same material, but it's just as a blob before it was formed into that. If this were inherently a bowl, could it before have been that blob of metal? But you look at it, no, there's bowl in, there's bell in here. There's definitely bell in. But if there's definitely bell in here, there should be bell in that blob of metal. But there's no bell in the blob of metal. There's no bowl in the blob of metal. There's only blob in the blob of metal. But is this a blob of metal? I'm going to put my noodles in a blob of metal. No, I am too sophisticated for that. I put my noodles in a bowl. Or in a bell. Do I put my noodles in a bell? You know? What kind of nut house are you taking me to?
Not so sophisticated.
Yeah. Okay. So it's very easy. I mean, it's very interesting to kind of look and really get the sensation of how everything appears so real, you know? Like, if this weren't a bell, what else exists? If this thing were not real, what else exists? Nothing could exist, you know? But then you start saying, well, if it were real, you know, how can it exist inherently, really, with its own essence? Yeah? Okay. But But still, when you look at it, it's real, isn't it? It's interesting when you do that with a person, too. Yeah? You know, a person. You label, you know, friend. Yeah? Just take some person and you label friend. Or you label relative. Relative is some, is, well, you can pick either one of them, you know? And you look and like, there's a real friend. There's a real relative. And they look so real, don't they? So, but why do I call them a real friend? What, when I look at that person, what is the friend in what is appearing to my mind? What is the friendness of what I'm seeing? Or the, you know, you think of a relative. What is the relativeness of that person that I'm seeing? That's why relatives sometimes can be more interesting. It's my genes. It's our blood. Yeah. They're a truly existent relative because we have the same genes. Yeah. Do you really have the same genes? If you had the same genes, then you would be them, wouldn't you?
Your genes are changing all the time.
Yes. Our genes are changing all the time, too. Or you say, we have the same blood. Well, no, they have their blood, I have my blood. And anyway, what's, when you look at blood, what is relative about that pool of blood? Yeah. People kill other people because they see blood and they say, that's my relative's blood. And so then they go kill somebody who killed their relative. But if you just look at a pool of blood, what is relative about that pool of blood? What is a person about that pool of blood? What is anything related to me about that blood or those genes or whatever it is? Yeah? It's nominally existent. It's imputed. It's fabricated. Does that make you feel weird? Especially when one part of your mind is holding on to a real friend or a real relative. But does it also give you a little bit more space in your mind? Yeah. A little bit more space, huh? And then it becomes easier to see that all sentient beings are basically the same, aren't they? That there's no one who is inherently close to us and no one that is inherently different, distant from us. That they're all basically the same and we're all basically the same. Yeah. That helps generate compassion, doesn't it? Yeah, much more equanimity in the mind. It gives us really some space in the mind. Okay. So 48. When there is this, that arises. Just as when there is long, there is short. When this is produced, that arises. Just as when a lamp's flame is produced, light arises. Okay, so this is talking about Prasangika's not contradicting what is well known in the world. Okay, so Joe Blow, you know, Joe Blow exists. He didn't give up. Well, actually, Nagarjuna came before Aryadeva, so Joe Blow was already existing here. With, yeah. So Joe Blow says, if an inherently existent cause doesn't give rise to an inherently existent effect, that contradicts what is well known in the world. Because we know that when you plant daisy seeds, daisies come out. Yeah, and when you plant bell peppers come out. Okay? And any farmer knows that when you plant seeds in the spring, you get a crop in the autumn. Okay? So this person's problem is that they can't differentiate between an inherently existent cause and conventionally existent or nominally existent cause and effect. Okay? So thus they think that when inherently existent causes and effects are refuted, then you're refusing cause and effect altogether. So this is the same problem again. Okay? So Nagarjuna explains that his assertion doesn't contradict common knowledge because he's not negating all existence, he's only negating inherent existence, an impossible way of existing. Okay? And the reason he's giving here in this verse is the reasoning of dependent arising. Okay. So this verse talks about two kinds of dependence. So one is causal. There's not just two kinds, but it talks of two kinds. So one is causal dependence, and the other is mutual dependence. Okay. So when there is this, that arises, and when that this is produced, meaning like the lamp, when the lamp is produced, that, meaning the light, arises. Yeah, so that's both causal dependence, both of those phrases. Okay, and it emphasizes that effects depend on their causes. But although they give us the gardening example a lot, we shouldn't just think of gardening. Yeah, we should think of the 12 links. Yeah. When there is ignorance, formative action arises. Okay? When there is formative action, consciousness arises. Right? When there is this, that arises. Okay? So it is with, you know, all of the 12 links. Each one of them arises dependent on the previous one. Yeah. So that's similar to the a light's flame giving rise to the light, or a lamp's flame giving rise to light. Okay, cause and effect. So if the cause and effect existed inherently, they would be totally independent of each other, and that would mean, you know, the whole causal system would break down. And you wouldn't need a cause to produce an effect, and an effect couldn't produce a cause anyway. Okay? So the cause and effect would all both be eternal, they would both exist simultaneously. You have all these unwanted consequences if you say that they're inherently existent. Okay? Then in the verse, when he says, when there is long, there is short, that indicates mutual dependence. So we call something long because we call something else short. Yeah. So there is maybe a little bit easier to see nominal existence. Oh, this is long. Yeah, we call it long because we call this short. This is big because we call that small. Okay? And those exist in relationship to each other. So in the same way, we could say this is weak suffering in relationship to strong suffering. Yeah? Or this is weak happiness in relationship to strong happiness. So it makes you think, you know, like if you were in the hell realms and then all of a sudden you were back in the human realms with a stubbed toe, you wouldn't say that you were suffering. You would say, oh, how happy I feel. Yeah? In comparison to what you were feeling in the hell realms. And that's why they say, like for the Aryas, the third kind of dukkha, the dukkha of pervasive conditioning, you know, for us, we just ignore that. We don't even consider that dukkha. But for the Aryas, that is extremely painful. It's like having like a thorn in your eye or something, you know, totally unbearable to them because they see it so clearly. Okay. Usually when we think of cause and effect, we think of cause and effect in terms of causal dependence. First you have the noodles, then you have the spaghetti. So we say the spaghetti is, spaghetti, you know, the whole dish of spaghetti. So we would say that the spaghetti is an effect of the noodles and the tomato paste, yeah. But, so that's in looking at the two in terms of causal dependence. If we look at them in term, cause and effect, in terms of mutual dependence, this is a little bit more profound, a little bit subtler, because we realize that you cannot call something a cause unless there were the possibility of it producing an effect. Usually we look at something that's a cause and see the cause as inherently existent. Yeah. Here, yeah, you see, well, that we only call that a cause because there's a potential to produce an effect. And we only call that effect because it arose due to something else. So that's looking at cause and effect in terms of mutual dependence, not in terms of causal dependence. Okay? So two things that are mutually reliant on each other don't exist inherently. They exist dependent on each other. Okay? So then you look around, then you see that so many things are dependent on each other. Cause and effect depend on each other. It's not just effects depending on causes, it's also causes depending on effects. Friend, enemy, and stranger all depend on each other. We usually think of them as three distinct groups. Actually, you know, pinpointing any of the groups depends on the existence of the other two groups. Yeah, you can't have a class of friends without having a class of strangers or enemies. Past, present, and future, likewise, all three depend on each other. They don't exist independently with their own nature inherently. So in this way, we get to see much more mutual dependence. And this one is really, this one can be really interesting, you know, especially when we, as a way to deal with when we feel I have this big problem, yeah, then you start looking my big problem and you realize that my big problem exists only in the context of everything else around it. Yeah, when I think of my problem, it seems there, independent, self-enclosed. But actually, it's only my, and it's only problem in the context of everything else that's around it. Because if there were something else different around it, it wouldn't be mine, and it wouldn't be a problem. And that gives you a really, it's a very good way to solve problems, actually. Yeah. Because you see, there's no real problem there. It's just called problem because of the whole, you know, thing. So it's just merely labeled, you know, in mutual dependence upon the whole big situation. You know, all these different factors that are going on, you know, and there you have the whole thing of the butterfly in Singapore flapping its wings, producing, you know, who knows what happening in the U.S. Yeah. Huh?
Zen.
Oh, yes, and the sand, right, producing all the hurricanes. Okay, so any questions? Yeah.
So you brought up the 12 lakes.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, why do they talk about there being two places where you can cut into it?
Why do they talk about two places? Because you can cut the 12 lakes because there are two places. And both of the two places come between an affliction and No. That's not right. They come in two different ways, okay? The first way you can cut it is between link one and link two. So if you eliminate ignorance, then you don't produce polluted karma, okay? The other place to cut it is between feeling and craving, okay? Because if we don't react to feelings of happiness, unhappiness, and neutral, or pain, pleasure, and neutral, if we react differently to those feelings, then we don't create the affliction of craving, which, you know, craving to have the pleasant feeling, craving to be free of the unpleasant feeling, craving for the neutral feeling never to disappear. Yeah? So we don't give rise to that craving, and without that craving, then the creation of karma and the ripening of karma ceases. Okay? So this is very interesting because, you know, the second one, because you start looking at all your feelings of happy and unhappy, and how we have such knee-jerk response to these feelings. Remember when we were doing the establishment of mindfulness on feelings? You meditate on this and you begin to see, boy, you know, I'm just like a, you know, a robot or a push-button thing. You know, slightest happy feeling, physically or mentally, craving for it. Slightest unpleasant feeling, physically or mentally, craving to be free of it. You know, it's like there's no equanimity in me at all. There's no ability to endure even the tiniest uncomfortable feeling. Yeah? We begin to see, boy, I'm really stuck, you know. Tiniest uncomfortable thing. And immediately, you know, get it away. Tiniest pleasurable thing, we grasp, you know. And how totally befuddled we are with this. Because, you know, when we're so reactive, and then, you know, we get reactive and we act and we create big messes, don't we? Yeah, such big messes, because we can't. We have no equanimity involving, you know, any kind of pleasant, unpleasant feeling. Yeah, and we really see how we're, you know, this is a problem.
So is it as deep as it could cut cyclic existence?
If what?
When they say that you can break this in two places, do they mean that you could actually
cut cyclic existence? Yeah.
That.
Yeah. It doesn't mean in 1 second you cut it. Yeah, but those are the two places where you can really cut cyclic existence. Yeah?
That's a difficult question, but without people to perceive it, would the Dharma exist? Without sentient beings to perceive the Dharma,
mm-hmm.
people to practice it, would the Dharma exist? Is the Dharma nominally existent?
Yeah, the Dharma is also nominally existent. Yeah? It exists because there's sentient beings who can realize it. Yeah? And the Dharma exists also in dependence on the Buddha and in dependence on the Sangha. So, you know, the point is here, even the holy objects not to reify them and make them into something concrete. Yeah?
So you're talking about stopping the reaction to positive, negative, or neutral feelings.
Mm-hmm. Happy, unhappy, pleasant, unpleasant.
Okay, yeah. But is, so it has to be cut between the feeling and the reaction.
Right.
You can't stop that judgment on the feeling?
No, you have the feeling. The feeling is just the raw experience. Yeah. Then our mind says, I don't like it, and reacts with craving.
Aversion.
Yeah, craving to be free of it. Yeah? So the thing is, you know, to experience the feeling without the mind going to, I don't like it, I can't stand it, I've got to get rid of it. That's where the equanimity comes in. Yeah? It's like, it's just a feeling. I don't need to latch on to good feelings, I don't need to push away bad feelings. It's just a feeling.
But there's no control over the feeling itself, only the reaction to it.
Huh?
There's no control over the feeling itself, just the reaction to it. The feeling
itself. Yeah, the feeling is comes, you know, you contact an object, and the experience of feeling is very much related to the ripening of karma. So, you know, that ripens, you have the feeling, but then how we respond is the big thing.
And the first place to cut, you said, was between ignorance and action.
And action, yeah.
Uh-huh. I always have this question, because ultimately, even you get some equanimity and don't react as quickly, it's still the same thing that cuts it, is the emptiness. I mean, the wisdom realizing emptiness in both places.
Yeah.
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 It's not like there's any other antidote to
right.
Or to mitigate it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we can develop some endurance for the feelings so we don't react as strongly. But the real thing that cuts them is the realization of emptiness. Yeah?
So going back to verse 46, folks online were just asking whether instead of saying nirvana is caused, which sounds contradictory, whether you could say instead nirvana is revealed or cessation is realized.
You can say realized, or you could say brought about. Yeah, brought about by. Okay, so, what? I just moved the verse. So we're on verse 49, right? Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it at long life, may I pacify completely all our inner hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Bodhisattva's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Yidam
Gurana Mandala Kamirya Dayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness, powerful. Sorrowful Tenzin Gyatso Chenresi. May you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Akshavasthi Abhi in the West, plural.